From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz, and this morning we speak with Ken Stern, founder and chair of the Longevity Project, which he launched in collaboration with the Stanford Center on Longevity. Stern reveals how strong social ties lead to longer lives in his new book, Healthy to 100, exploring how social connection is the missing link in America's health span. Then, since we just set our clocks back, in the back and forth with daylight savings time, science journalist Lynn Peoples tells us why our circadian rhythms deserve better. She shares the fascinating and often surprising science of our internal timekeepers in her book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. These guests when we come back.
This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Our next guest is Ken Stern, a nationally recognized expert on longevity and aging, founder of the Longevity Project, and host of the acclaimed Century Lives podcast from the Stanford Center on Longevity.
Now, with the launch of his new book, Healthy to 100, How Strong Social Ties Lead to Longer Lives, Stern joins us to share why Americans' healthy life expectancy lags far behind other nations and what we can learn from global models of aging well. He reveals how strong social ties are the key to longevity, how we must re-engineer our systems to support meaningful life beyond retirement, and why this shift is imperative as we face both an aging population and declining birth rates. Ken Stern, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Social connection, how important is that? You know, if you have this trifecta of diet, exercise, and social ties, where does it lie? You really feel it's the most important?
So let me answer that in two ways, Lynn. One is the research shows that being lonely, the other side of social connection, is roughly equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So it's important. I mean, right away, it's important. How you value that against, you know, nutrition, exercise, they're all important. I would say, I don't know that there's a ranking, but I would say that Americans as a whole underestimate and underweight the value of social connection. So whether it's more or less important than other things, I'm not sure how I would answer that question. But I would say that Americans really need to up their game on social connections.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, Mary Beth and I have lived in this community, Park City, Utah, for a very long time, like our entire adult lives, basically. Because it is a very popular resort town, a lot of people who've lived here a long time say, you know what, I'm going to leave this place. It's not what it used to be. I'm leaving. And then they stop and they think about when they go to the grocery store and they see five people they know, and when they go to the post office, they see five people they know, and they have these conversations, and then they realize, oh, wait a minute, this is my social everything here, whether it's people that are acquaintances or really people we have deep friendships with. And that keeps us here. It keeps me here. And I realize it's important, but a lot of people move later on in life after retirement. They move to Arizona or whatever, you know, get warm. So what about that? That seems to be a really uprooting kind of behavior.
So, we're a very mobile transit society. One of the great trends of the 20th century is urbanization. People left their communities behind, moved, and that has continued into the 21st century. And it's a very, very strange and oddly American thing that was actually invented in the 1960s. The whole retirement community idea didn't exist before 1960. It was actually really a developer by the name of Del Webb who came up with this idea. And he created Sun City in Arizona. And he sort of convinced Americans that there was value in picking up and leaving behind relationships of a lifetime and move to a place where you don't know anyone. And that's a very strange and unique thing that we do in America that doesn't really exist elsewhere. I think part of the reason that was successful is because we don't really know in America what to do with older people. We underweight their value. They feel left behind. That's why retirement communities are often successful, because they say, hey, this is a place where people will treat what you value, where you can be the center of the action. So I understand why it's attractive to a lot of people, but it's a very odd thing in the broader context of thinking about maintaining relationships, leaving all of them behind and moving to a place where you don't know anyone.
Yeah, and we do see a lot of retirees move to our area in Utah. You know, it's got great weather, it's very conducive to staying active. But my in-laws moved here from Chicago a few years ago, and they play pickleball, thank goodness. It may save America. But besides that, I think they found it really difficult to meet new people. They're not in the workplace. They're not, you know. Do you have any just direct suggestions to people who are moving to new areas about how to start strengthening those social ties?
Yeah, it's hard because most of our relationships come from So I think one of the things we understand is there's a lot of research on where friendships come from, and it's usually from proximity. So the research says you need to be near someone for 50 hours to be friends, 200 hours to be close friends, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can think about where do your friendships come from? They come from often from work, because you're just around those people hour after hour, from school, from neighborhoods. That's where friendships come from. So it's just hard to move to a new place when you don't have that built in. So the things that, you know, to go to my book, the other countries are doing sort of create social connection. They're making work easier for people. So the idea of working in retirement is increasingly attractive to a lot of people. Volunteering is another way that people find connections around an area of passion. Lifelong learning, going back to school, being in a classroom, not digitally, but being in a classroom next to someone is a way to build relationships. Those are all things, plus pickleball, of course, that people can do if they want to think about how do I increase my web of social connections in a place that I may not have enough.
I was an American culture major in college, and we used to just nerd out on stuff like this, on what kind of forces were happening all throughout culture to cause major shifts. And so I was thinking about this a lot when preparing for this interview, and it struck me as the 50s, even though Del Webb in the 60s, that makes a lot of sense about what we expect for retirement, but it feels like in the post-war 50s, youth culture suddenly got this big power infusion, all the post-war prosperity and music and media was exploding. Are we still riding on the coattails of that excitement about youth, or is there many, many things that are happening that are leading to where we are to think about aging?
Well, so I think a couple of things. So Mary Beth, I think you're quite right. So the U.S. has the most age-divided society on Earth by a lot of measures. Wow. Has among the most ageist views of sort of generational conflict. And I think that a lot of that evolves from two trends, both that came together, I think you're quite right, in the 50s and 60s. One of which was the exaltation of youth and youth culture, which is continued to this day. The other piece of it is, until then, we didn't have a lot of old people. The number of people over the age of 65, there obviously were people over 65, but the number really exploded starting around in the post-war era. I track centenarians, that's just one little measure of it and sort of an outsider measure, but it's an easy one to think about. When I was born in 1963, there were probably 3,000 people in the U.S. around the age of 100. Today, there's over 100,000, and by the mid-century, it's supposed to be around 400,000. So it's just an explosion of people in later generations, and we as a country have really grappled with the notion of, hey, our timelines have changed. We really need to rethink about how we live our longer lives. And I think the good news is other countries have, because they've actually been more successful in aging. So they've reached sort of this age tunnel before us. So they have both been more successful and also compelled to rethink sort of this map of life to make sure that the second half of life can be as valuable and meaningful as the first.
Ken, I'm wondering, it's a good thing we brought up pickleball because you hear people who are really obsessed with it, and there are a lot of obsessed pickleball players. The first thing they say is, it's so fun. And the second thing they say is, it's so social. It's really a wonderful thing. And I'm wondering, what is the equivalent to pickleball in some of the countries that you looked at? Like, you start off talking about Japan.
So before I answer that, I'm going to deviate with a little story. So I played for my podcast, Century Lives, we do it, everything is in a season. So we're doing a season on housing, and where, sort of the question you've all been asking, where do people live? So I went down to a retirement community called Margaritaville in Florida just about a month ago, and spent 2 days there. And in the second day, they made me go out and play my first match of pickleball. And it was like 8 in the morning, it was like 95 degrees, it was Panama City, Florida. And there were about 70 people hanging out the courts. And you know, that some were playing, most were hanging out. And it really was both very social and also a lesson that I'm really out of shape. But that's, so, you know, you don't find in other countries, I mean, I'm sure there's pickleball, although I didn't see it in any countries. I think the issue in other countries is really focus on meaning and purpose in the second half of life. So in Japan, for instance, which you mentioned, Lynn, they have the highest rate of older workers. That's because two things have happened. One is people in Japan associate working with purpose and meaning. So older people want to keep working. So just for their own, just like people want to eat right or exercise here, they want to keep working because they think that is good for their health. And the second thing that's happened is they've created essentially a new work economy for older workers because there's so many of them and they don't want to work the same. Japan has a notoriously stressful work environment, but around age 60, the rules change. There's a lot more part-time work. There's a lot of job sharing. There's a lot of use of technology. Very few people work full-time after the age of 65, but roughly half of people after 65 to 70 and then declining amounts work part-time because that's working in retirement. And that's another way of creating meaning and purpose and social connection in the second half of life. And some other things that other countries done, they've actually gotten rid of senior centers in some places and created centers for all ages. How do you create interactions between generations? How do you create more reason for people of different ages to come together in a natural way? So there's a lot of different ways that people, that countries and societies have for putting older people in sort of in the center of things.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Ken Stern. He's a nationally recognized expert on longevity and aging. His new book is called Healthy to 100, How Strong Social Ties Lead to Longer Lives. He's also the host of the Century Lives podcast. You just said something that caught my attention, which is coming to various age groups coming together in a natural way. And it made me think of maybe a contrived way that we put, say, seniors in the elementary school so they read with kids. Is that, I don't know, does that work? It seems like a great idea, but, you know, is it really creating a social bond there, you know, programs like this?
Yeah, they do work. So I'll just tell you another story. This is actually from the U.S., a place in Maine called Gorham House, which is a nursing home and preschool. So they're actually co-located. And you might think that's a little bit of a contrivance, just as you were asking about, Lynn. But when you go there, you see both the values or the joy it brings on a regular basis to older people, which I think is analogous to going into schools and reading. But the story that I came away with is actually how meaningful it is for younger people, for the kids. The elementary school teachers in Gorham have told the preschool teacher that kids who come out of that program are the most empathetic kids. So like when a new kid in a wheelchair came into class, into an elementary school class in Gorham, most of the kids didn't know what to do with them, but the kids who had gone through the Gorham school program, first they see people in wheelchairs all the time, and they were just in tune to differences, physical differences in the way that other kids aren't. And I think we should recognize how valuable intergenerational relationships are, pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that fit together, how valuable that is both older folks in terms of meaning, purpose, and just energy, and how valuable it is to younger people because some of the research that shows kids, at-risk kids who have a friend or mentor, unrelated friend or mentor, do much better than other kids without. That's just a really valuable way of organized society that we've kind of forgotten about.
That is a fantastic combo. I've not heard about that in Gorham, and I just love it. My son Scout was a part of a program we have here in Park City called Sages and Seekers, where they put teenagers and older folks together, and they're partnered up. And so they'd meet up. They'd have a meetup once a month, I think. Scout's buddy was so funny. He was a storyteller, and Scout would come back with these crazy tales. I'm like, is that true? And he was just like, I don't know if it matters. The guy is just really fun, and he tells these great stories. And I think that Scout started taking part in it to try to do a nice thing, but actually just really enjoyed it. And that's kind of the rub, is that you can go into things with the best of intentions, thinking it's for the common good, but it's when it's really enjoyable that things take off.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a great story, Mary Beth, and I love that program. And there are programs that I come across. I mean, I mentioned Gorham House, and I come across them a lot, and they're fantastic. But they're sort of the exception rather than the rule. The one thing that, you know, people ask me, you know, I wrote the book, and I try to write about sort of different things in each place. So I wrote about lifelong learning in Korea, where it's lifelong learning is a constitutional right. I wrote about work in Japan. But the one thing that actually connected all those countries, that every country did, because that is sort of organizing principle, was to bring the generations together. And some of the things like Centers for All Ages in Singapore, they don't have senior housing anymore. They just put the senior, you know, they just integrate seniors into regular housing. They put playgrounds, exercise courses for older folks. They just organize society to bring the generations together. And that's true across all these healthy aging countries. And it's a model that, again, we've kind of lost, and we only do in sort of, you know, small incremental programs from, you know, in some places.
Right. Let me ask you this. Do you think that men, or do you observe that men or women struggle more with aging? Because my guess would be that women do, because, you know, that change in reproductive ability, just even evolutionarily, would make them less valuable to the tribe or something. And yet women seem to have much, and I could be wrong, but much stronger social ties as they age. So I was just kind of curious as to what you found with gender.
So that's an interesting and complicated question. So one thing I found in everywhere I've gone, in the US, everywhere I travel a lot, I talk to a lot of people about this, women are much more socially connected than men, everywhere you go. And that means if you go to a senior center, you go to a program, or you go, you know, almost anything you do, it's almost always dominated by women. And the people who run it are always trying to figure out, how do you get men out of the house and engaged? So men are a much bigger challenge, and it's one of the reasons why almost universally, there's a biological factor as well, but universally women live longer than men. That's actually true in humans, it's true in mammals. In the US, women outlive men by 5.3 years, and the global average is 5.4. It's a universal truth. The other side of the coin, the less attractive side of the coin, is women always live longer, but they almost always live longer in poor health, more percentage of years in poor health. And that's because some of the factors you were referring to, Mary Beth, they live more stressful lives, they have more caregiving responsibilities, they make less money, they're often victims of domestic abuse and violence. All those things add up to stressful, less healthy lives in the long run. So it's a complicated equation between men and women. But in terms of social connection, one of the big challenges, like especially men who've worked all their lives and then retire and then essentially fall off a cliff, you know, all their social connections come from work. That's true for a lot of us. And all of a sudden they're gone. One day they're here and the next day you're forgotten. Men in particular, but people in general don't often know how to handle that. And it's very hard.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Ken, I guess I've seen a lot of people in my, you know, tribe, for lack of a better word, they're in varying stages of retirement, and it's either semi-retirement, they're fully retired. And most of them say, you know, I really love to work, and so I'm going to retire, but I'm going to give it a little time and then decide what I'm going to do in terms of volunteering or, you know, working at one of the ski resorts, Deer Valley or Park City part-time. And then what I've seen happen a lot of times is they start to get kind of selfish about their free time, and they don't want to have commitments. And I'm just wondering what advice you would give to someone who's sort of on the precipice of like thinking, oh, I really should be volunteering, but I don't really want to have commitments. You know, what do you say to people about that sort of thing?
It's a hard one, right? So I say to them, I encourage people to be selfish for themselves. And I say, but think about it as you're doing this for what it brings to you. So, and be disciplined about it. You're mostly disciplined, I would say to a lot of people I know, you're mostly disciplined about what you eat, and you're mostly disciplined about trying to get your 10,000 steps or things like that in. Treat social connection the same way. Bring into it the same discipline and planfulness. You may not be perfect, who is, in terms of their eating or exercise, but treat this as seriously as you do the rest, because that's good for you. Don't, you know, not want to give up your work. Cheating on that is the same as, like, you know, stealing a piece of chocolate cake. You can do it every so often, but you need to be disciplined, and, you know, social connection requires the same amount of discipline. When people hear social connection, they often think about how we talk about social connection, which is, you know, being the life of the party or, you know, block captain. But I actually mean creating a web of essentially ecosystem of connections, often around work or learning or something like that, that puts you next to people all the time. You could be an introvert and do it. You can be an extrovert and do it. But put yourself in a place, because it's good for you, that you're going to be connected with people. And work is often the most, you know, obvious a source of connection for a lot of people.
That's interesting. You've mentioned lifelong learning a couple of times, and I wanted you to tell us more about Korea. That's one of the places you went, and that's what you observed, is this reinvention of learning to engage older adults.
Oh, yeah. So Korea's, so it's crazy, actually. So the interesting thing, you know, we tend to think of learning something that you were formally doing the first 18, 21, 25 years. And then you might learn idiosyncratically or for work after that. But in Korea, they really think of, it's in the constitution, that lifelong learning is something you should do for your whole life. And virtually every city has become a lifelong learning city, which is a designation from the Ministry of Education, where they are committed to having classrooms in every neighborhood within a 5 to 10 minute walk and creating curricula for older adults to learn. And it's really quite important in Korea, which is got the lowest birth rate in the world, and one of the, and I think second or third in terms of life expectancy. So they actually need to have older people socially engaged, productive, and they found that lifelong learning is really an important way to accomplish that. So it really is a reinvention of the idea of education, something that is formally done for the first, you know, third of life, to something that's done over the course of an entire lifetime. And that's a real big rethink. That's, I think, very exciting.
I had an experience a while ago where my kids had an app on the iPad that could ageify you. It could make you like a baby yeah. or make you older. And so I slid it all the way to the elderly side. And I have to say, it kind of traumatized me, because number one, you always think you're going to be the way you are now forever. But I just started looking at myself, and it made me think of, I don't want to be old. It made me feel fearful. And I feel like I'm living a great life. I have nothing that would indicate that being older would be a bad thing for me. But that was just some weird bias that's living in me. What can we do to be the change we want to see in the world? How can we work on our own attitudes if they bubble up and they're not what we'd like them to be about aging?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, we have definitely built in a bias that sort of sees the later years of decline and diminishment. And that's a little scary. And we've built a narrative around it, and it's hard. And the people it affects most is actually older people. We tend to think about sort of ageism and think about how younger people view older people, but actually the most harmful is how older people view themselves. and it actually has direct consequences for health. Becca Levy at Yale has done research that shows people with positive attitudes towards aging tend to outlive people with negative views about aging by about 8 years. So it's in our own interest to have positive views of aging. The interesting thing is, but you know, our views of aging are built up by over generations, and that app probably doesn't help a lot when we see ourselves sort of physically age in ways that are a little uncomfortable. The truth of the matter is, older people actually still tend to be pretty happy. They are more socially isolated, they're more lonely, but they have built up capacities to be happier. It's called the U-curve of happiness. You're happier when you're young and when you're old. It's actually a time of happiness, and people should look forward to that. And the second thing is, you know, the more and more role models out there of people living really engaged, positive lives into their 70s, 80s, 90s. Jane Goodall just died at 91. She died when she was out on a trip making a speech. She made 300 trips a year into her 90s. So Mel Brooks just announced Spaceballs 2, which will come out in 2027 when he's 101. He's going to act it. We're not all going to be Jane Goodalls or Mel Brooks's. But there are models for us for how living really successful, happy, engaged lives. And I think that's the trick, is to focus on them and think, how can I live a life like that, or as close to that as humanly possible?
We are very lucky here in this community because we have a lot of great models. You know, people who I know in their 80s who are living those kind of lives. And it makes you say, I am okay at X age, whatever it is, and we have that to look forward to. We also have your book to look forward to, Ken.
Yes.
The book is Healthy to 100, How Strong Social Ties Lead to Longer Lives. It's so inspirational, and we're so happy that you could join us today, Ken Stern, on The Mountain Life. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. As Americans fall back this November, important questions come to mind about the real cost of changing the clocks twice a year. What toll does it take on our sleep, safety, and health? Science journalist Lynn Peoples joins us today to explore the fascinating and often surprising science of our internal timekeepers.
Lynn's book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms, dives into how policy, culture, and modern life pull us out of sync, and what it would take to align our lives with natural time. From something called social jet lag to sleep deserts and the politics of light, Lynn brings both data and humanity to one of the most universal challenges we face, living well with the rhythms of our biology. Lynn Peoples, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
We, I think, very often disregard our circadian rhythms, or at least we do when we have to travel back and forth between time zones, you know, with three time zones in this country, and then, you know, twice a year when we jump forward, then fall back. Why should we not be disregarding our circadian rhythms?
Well, science is unraveling more and more just how critical our circadian rhythms are for all our body systems. You know, we think about sleep. When I talk to people about circadian rhythms, that comes to mind. And of course, it is driving our sleep patterns. But so much of our physiology is reliant on having these inner clocks in sync. And that means in sync with the planet's 24-hour patterns, the light, the dark. When we lose touch with that, when we fail to align with the Earth's rhythms, our internal clocks fall out of alignment with that and with each other. So essentially, you know, they're programmed to peak at the right times of day for that particular process. So we're talking, you know, metabolism, immunity, all these critical features of our physiology that we evolved with on this planet. And so when they fall out of sync, our health can be compromised, our productivity can be compromised, and of course our sleep can be compromised. And there's just so many things that we do in modern life that derails that critical system. And that includes daylight saving time, flip flopping, jet lag, as you mentioned, and also just our indoor lifestyle. We spend upwards of 90% of our time indoors. We don't have access to that daylight that we evolved with.
Well, I'm wondering then, what does that say for the physiology of someone who lives near the equator? Light and dark amounts of time in a day are similar year-round versus someone who lives above the Arctic Circle in the upper reaches of Norway or wherever, where they're really experiencing such vast differences in the amount of light and then the amount of day. Granted, they have time, their bodies probably adjust to it, but it is quite extreme. So what's the difference there?
It's a really good point. So we evolved at the equator, and really, truly, for optimal health, in a way, we all should still be living at the equator. But obviously, that's not practical. So yes, the further you go from the equator, the more difference there is, you know, time of year based on how many hours of daylight we have. And if you go up to Alaska or further north, in the spring and fall, day length rapidly changes. And researching the book, I spoke with a lot of people that live there, a lot of sleep scientists that lived up in Alaska, and they talked about the high rates of all kinds of health ailments, mental health problems that peak during those times. Because we're not, most of our genetics are not allowing us to adapt quickly enough to those changing daylight patterns. So yeah, at the equator, you get 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark. It's the same year round. And we are not, the body's not forced to be flip-flopping and constantly be struggling with jet lag.
Right. When I was growing up, I was in a town that had some factories and farmers and different people who had different kind of sleep patterns. And someone I knew worked nights at the factory. Mm-hmm. And it was a fascinating thing to me to hear about some of the challenges with that and how doing that for years had created a lot of stress on his mental health and his body. I think we can imagine, you know, sure, we're tired or we feel a little bit sluggish, but what other kind of health things happen when we're not aligned with the way our bodies would like to be in rhythm with the earth and everything around us?
Yeah, that's where a lot of this new science is coming out. That really is adding to the list of potential risks of falling out of alignment. So studies of, as you mentioned, shift workers in particular are finding higher rates of metabolic diseases like diabetes. There are some hints that there are increased rates of cancer in that population. The risk of making a mistake, if you're thinking about a medical worker, for example, if they are on a night shift or in particular, one of those rotating shifts where they're constantly changing what hours are quote unquote day for them. Those kind of scenarios are just going to elevate the risks of these things. So again, health, productivity, all those, you know, things that a lot of us take for granted are a challenge in that population. And I think, you know, we're really just kind of coming to grips with that. I don't think it's fully acknowledged, and perhaps those workers may not be fully supported in the challenges that they do face, but the science is getting pretty strong that they really are facing a lot of risks in that position.
Sure. Well, a few years ago here in town, there was a real big movement to start making the school times start later, because especially for teenagers, they were saying that their circadian rhythms are really shifting during that time of their lives. Can you tell us about the different needs or tendencies of our bodies during different phases of life and how it affects our circadian rhythms?
Yeah, absolutely. So we all tick differently. You know, we hear about early birds and night owls, and there is everything in between. So we all have a unique inner circadian system. And within ourselves, that does, as you mentioned, change across the course of our life as well. So when we're born, we may not really have much of a rhythm, right? As parents can attest to, sleeping at all hours of the day. And then early childhood, we might be being a little early bird on average. And then when we hit adolescence, then biologically, teenagers tend to drift later. They tend to be more of a night owl. And at least in the US and a lot of other countries, Historic school start times have been later for those kids. So you go to elementary school, maybe at like 9 a.m. start. Middle school, high school, at least for me, started earlier. So high school for me started at 7:30. And there are still many schools around the country that follow that same schedule. And that's biologically backwards. So at that age, we really should be allowing those kids to sleep in a little bit to live in tune with their inner clocks.
And so that's not just laziness of teenagers, as our grandparents might say. This is a biological thing.
It's a biological thing. Of course, there are behavioral factors, and we can't overlook the fact that screen time, social media, all these things could be playing a role. But they're also, they interact with one another. I mean, if we think about light at night, screen time at night, that is actually exacerbating perhaps that tendency to be up later because you're exposed to blue light, which tells your inner clock it's daytime. It confuses your system. So I think these things play in with each other and make it all the more challenging for these kids. But yes, there are at least a substantial portion of it that is biological. It is not their fault.
You made me think, Lynn, about how, I mean, I watch TV at night. I do. And I have a TV in my bedroom. And that's the only place in my house that I have a TV because it actually puts me to sleep. So you might want to argue that, and sleep experts might want to argue that. But to me, it's that wind down time that you're not doing anything else. You're just kind of being entertained. And it's probably why I fall asleep naturally. It never keeps me up. It never stimulates me. And so I know that kids don't want to hear us tell them that they can't look at screens either. But what's the difference there? What is wrong about our behavior of, you know, having a TV in the bedroom?
Well, you make a really good point. I mean, it's all a balance and it's all personal. And there's a lot of things to think about here. And one is, you know, we hear about that screen time, the blue light from the screens. And sure, there is some aspect there of that blue light potentially messing with our circadian rhythms, suppressing melatonin. But in particular, a TV, especially at a distance, the amount of blue light that's probably reaching your eyes is probably minimal. And then there's also the idea that, I guess you said it, watching TV at night, that's your, it's kind of a cue for your body that it's time to rest, it's time to relax. And if that screen time, I mean, even if it's on your phone and you're, you know, a teenager, if it's relaxing you, that's going to counteract probably any potential risk of that light affecting your circadian rhythms. So it's all a balance. Again, if it's content that's stimulating, stressful, that's one thing. If it's, you know, cute cat videos or something mindless, that's another. So that point was raised to me quite often by scientists. It's really a balance. All these things are not black and white, but the blue light getting into your eyes, especially later at night, can potentially derail sleep in your inner clocks.
Huh. Okay. Well, that brings to light just the whole notion of melatonin, how it's naturally released in our bodies, and then, you know, how we take it as a quote unquote supplement to help us fall asleep or stay asleep. I don't know. Does that sort of thing really work?
That's really interesting because this was new to me while doing research for my book, but I had taken melatonin, you know, off and on when I was having bouts of insomnia. And as scientists pointed out to me, you have to be really careful. Melatonin can work, you know, maybe on the whole, we take it too often, which there might be potential ramifications there. But taken, you know, occasionally, especially to help maybe overcome jet lag or something, very small dose. So we're talking more like 1 milligram, not maybe the 5 or more that you could get in over-counter melatonin pills. That can help. And the timing at which you take melatonin is critical. So, you know, I used to be popping the pill right before bed, hoping that would help me fall asleep. You really want to be taking it 2-3 hours before you go to bed, because that is when the body's natural melatonin is starting to rise. And you want to time it with that. Because if you take it later, that could actually backfire and throw off your rhythm because your body's thinking, oh, well, that's the time that I should be ramping up melatonin. So then perhaps the next night, your inner clocks will be drifted later and it might make it harder to fall asleep that next night. So timing, dose are very important in if you do feel you need to take melatonin.
Wow, that's interesting. I have tried some military techniques to adjust my sleep patterns that suggested you time your meals in certain ways, you know, feast, famine, feast, famine. I believe it seems to help me, but I am highly suggestible. How does eating affect our circadian rhythms?
Yeah, another area of circadian science that is providing us some clues. So there are studies that show if we consolidate the hours during the day that we eat, in particular, if we really try to cut off taking in any calories, say 3 hours before we go to bed, then our bodies are going to have an easier time staying in sync again with that day-night rhythm of the planet, and also kind of the direct effects. If you think about eating a late night meal, that is sending a lot of blood to your gut. It's, you know, especially if it's sugar or fat, it's really ramping up your systems. Our ancestors, you know, we evolved to eat during the day, not during the night. We just have access now, right? 24/7 access to food from our fridge, from the corner store, from our restaurant. We didn't evolve that way. So kind of, I think that one strategy I really suggest to people is just kind of put your head back in, you know, the place of our ancestors. How were they living? What was practical at that time? And that's not that we need to necessarily go back and live out on outdoors, you know, 7 days a week, but think about how they might have lived. So yeah, we were eating during the day, sleeping at night, and the science is backing up that idea that if we consolidate the hours that we eat, we might improve our sleep and in particular improve our metabolism. So they're linking a lot of those late night meals to potentially greater risks of diabetes. And also back to the question earlier about shift work, one cool new finding that's giving some hope is if shift workers, despite working at night, if they try to consolidate their meals to daylight hours, so maybe eating, you know, right before a shift or after and trying to leave that night, you know, free of calories or, you know, at least minimal, that could reduce those risks that shift work raises, you know, including diabetes.
That's so interesting. So maybe all of these elderly folks who like to eat dinner at 4:30 are onto something because they're giving their bodies lots of time to digest before dinner.
Absolutely, before yes. And hey, it's happy hours cheaper too. So happy hour prices.
So true. What kind of things do you recommend at this time of year when we are falling back? It's always a happy time for a lot of the kids and a lot of the folks who have trouble waking up early. How can we best adjust to changes in time, whether it's something like this or jet lag or anything?
Yeah, I think it's really to primarily get daylight during the day and get morning light. So our systems, that those 24-hour, approximately 24-hour clocks in our body need that regular calibration. And so if we're shifting an hour later or an hour earlier, just like if you're traveling across time zones, you want to help your body adapt, you know, as quickly as possible to that local time, even if we haven't changed places and it's just the clock on the wall. So getting morning light, so taking advantage of that light that's now, you know, quote unquote, up earlier, you want to, you know, also kind of adjust when you're eating your meals. And you can do this ahead of time. So, you know, in anticipation of our changing our clocks, you might allow your body to more slowly adjust, you know, maybe get up or sleep in just a little bit later, depending on which way we're flip-flopping in the clocks. Adjust your meal times. You know, there's really three things, you know, regardless of the time of the year, regardless of whether you're traveling, that I point to, and that is contrast, that's increasing the light during your day, particularly the mornings, darkening your nights, really giving your body that cue that this is day, this is night, you know, and assemble accordingly to your clocks, consolidating meals like we talked about, and then consistency. So that's trying to go to bed and get up at the same time every day, which, as we were hinted at earlier, is particularly hard for some people, including high school students, when school starts so early. But those are really the key things: contrast, consolidate, consistency.
I wanted to ask you, you know, much like when Mary Beth was talking about school start times and the struggle and how hardly anyone has been successful, any school districts, in changing that school start time, there's also been so much talk about legislating away the daylight savings time. But it's been talked about forever, and it has not happened yet. Why not?
Yeah, so since 2018, legislators have been proposing this so-called Sunshine Protection Act to make permanent daylight saving time for the country. Thankfully, according to scientists, that hasn't gone through yet. But there has been, every year around this time, we start talking about whether or not to lock our clocks. It's been really held up because nobody can agree on where we would lock the clock. You know, do we lock it on standard time? Do we lock it on daylight saving time? And the way federal law states, we can't change to permanent daylight saving time, or no state can change to permanent daylight saving time without an act of Congress. However, to change to permanent standard time, states have free rein, and Arizona and Hawaii are good examples of that. They don't flip-flop their clocks. But so one by one, states have been kind of debating this for themselves, which way to go. A lot have decided permanent daylight saving time is what they want, and they're kind of waiting on Congress to act to make that a true possibility. And then, you know, a little bit more and more, there's states talking about permanent standard time. Because A, it's easier way to lock the clocks. We don't have to wait for the federal government. And that is what the science is pointing to. So you talk to just about any sleep scientists, circadian scientists, and they will make the point that standard time is more in line with our inner clocks. If we were to stay on daylight saving time, that's essentially, you know, stealing an hour of that morning light that we know is so critical to keep our clocks in tune, and adding it to the end of the day, which is when we want dark nights. We want, again, brighter early days, you know, brighter mornings, afternoons, darker nights to keep our clocks in tune. And a big part of that is the fact that on average, our inner clocks are ticking longer than 24 hours. So if you think about that word circadian, circa means around or about, Tian is day. So our clocks are not ticking at exactly 24 hours a day like the planet we're on. They need that constant calibration, primarily from those light and dark cycles, to keep constantly recalibrated. So if we're, you know, on average a little longer than 24 hours, that morning light is kind of pulling us back every day. It's pulling us back to be at 24 hours, to be closer in sync with the planet. And then that's in turn helping all our systems stay in sync with each other to ensure that it's ready and primed to do the right things at the right times, whether that's sleep or fend off invading pathogens or digest food. But yeah, the critical thing, I mean, this is, as scientists point out, it really varies depending on where you live, just how important, you know, these considerations are, and they can be different. And in Seattle, the key that resonated with me is the idea that if we were on permanent daylight saving time, there would be about 2 months of the year in which the sun wouldn't rise till after 8:30 a.m. And that's, you know, at least to me, that's sort of appalling. That's scary. I mean, granted, in the summertime, the sun rising at 4 or 5 a.m., don't need that. That's not really hours I partake of. And sometimes that light sneaks into my bedroom and wakes me up. So there's no perfect solution here. But the science, the medical science, is really pretty clear at this point that if we have to pick, and we kind of do because the flip-flopping's not healthy either, that standard time is the far healthier way to go.
Okay, that is making sense. What you're saying is it's just more about the morning. And the morning time and the daylight time is the most important time for us to really take it, our bodies to take advantage of the light, to set it back to the 24, as close as it can be to the 24-hour cycle. Okay, very interesting. Well,
and with the caveat that, again, it's personal. So if you are naturally a true early bird and your clock runs shorter than 24 hours, hey, in your case, maybe permanent daylight saving time would be the better bet. But we have to think population-wide, right? I mean, we have to make policy across the board. And so that's where, again, on average, it's gonna be more beneficial.
Okay, well, that all makes very much sense. Mary Beth and I are very different, I think, in our sleep habits. She's more of a night owl. I can be asleep by 8:30. Yeah, so I would like standard time.
Another point that sometimes is overlooked, even though we know it, is nobody likes these shorter days, right? Wintertime, the day length shrinks. But by going on permanent daylight saving time, you know, it's sort of a misnomer. And this Sunshine Protection Act, a bit of a misnomer. There's nothing we can do to add extra hours of daylight in the winter. You know, we have what we got, right? And it's just kind of, it's this allocation, you know, what part of the day are we going to align those daylight hours? And that really rests on how we schedule our lives and what kind of, you know, start times we have for schools or workplaces. And if those are super strict, then all this matters. If it wasn't for that, we could live by the sun, you know, and it wouldn't really necessarily matter what time on the, you know, the clock on the wall says.
Yeah, okay, that's so interesting, a misnomer. It really is. You're just adjusting. You're not getting more daylight. And somehow we've been led to believe it, which is kind of funny if you think rationally.
I just wondered, I keep reading all the time about how getting out and getting a little bit of actual sunlight first thing in the morning is a good, healthful practice. About how long do we need to spend in that sunlight to get decent effects from it?
You know, the kind of rule of thumb I go by and what I've kind of pulled together from various scientists is maybe 20 minutes. You know, it doesn't take a lot, 15, 20 minutes. And it's not black and white. Again, everybody is different. Everybody's system processes that light differently, needs different amounts, needs different brightness. But it's pretty fair that if you want to just go for a walk and get coffee, walk to work, even just sitting really close to a window and making sure your eyeballs are looking out that window for a while, that can make a big difference.
That's a really good point. I've even heard that to go outside barefoot and connect with the earth is all part of this ritual. So I oftentimes go out first thing in the morning. I go out one door of the house barefoot and I walk around to the other door. So that takes me about 45 seconds. I thought that was good enough.
The same thing, Lynn. My kids give me a hard time, like, oh, mom's out in the backyard grounding. But hey, it works for me.
Hey, that's all that matters. Hey, and if you do that 45 second little routine on the regular throughout the day, it adds up.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to keep in mind, it's not just that morning dose. That's critical. But if you can get little snacks of light throughout the day, that'll add up and really help you as well.
Well, the book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And our guest has been science journalist Lynn Peoples. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
It is. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. You can find this episode and past episodes on our website at kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or wherever you find your podcasts under KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you liked this episode, please rate us and share it with a friend. If you have a suggestion for a guest or a topic, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.